All righty, it is 3 minutes after 8 o'clock. You've got it on KHUM, cutting Eureka, Arcata, and Willow Creek, and streaming on the web at KHUM.com. Our 18th Stop the Violence, Start the Healing campaign is going on here at KHUM, and all this week we are talking with sexual assault in our own military. We've had several really terrific conversations thus far on the campaign, and we are going to continue this with our two-hour roundtable discussion, and we've got all kinds of folks here in the studio, so I think what we'll do is we'll start by introducing, because one of our guests is actually not in the studio, all the way in Arizona. So we'll start off with my partner for the past 18 years doing this here at KHUM, Sherry Johnson.
Good morning.
Good morning,
Sherry. Everybody.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing great.
Give your credentials.
I am the Department of Social Works at Humboldt State University's field director. And I'm also the chair of the Humboldt County Domestic Violence Coordinating Council. And to my left
is Marianne Hayes. Marianne with the North Coast Rape Crisis Team.
And thank you so much for coming back. And Paula, if you're listening, we are sending you our love and wish you were here. But I know you're waiting in pre-surgery circumstances. So we're going to just be sending you healing energy and wishing you well.
For those who aren't aware, Paula Arrowsmith-Jones was involved in a multi-vehicle car accident on her way here for our first week's topic, and unfortunately has been out of commission dealing with various different medical issues, but luckily she is doing well. And we also have another guest with us on the telephone. Maureen, why don't you introduce yourself?
Good morning, everyone. I want to send good wishes to Paula now that I've heard about that. That's terrible. I am a retired military tactical intelligence officer, 20 years Air Guard up in Washington, and also a semi-retired academic. I was a professor of English. And so my approach to this topic of assault against women, particularly in the military, is from a theoretical approach about the culture.
Okay, and I definitely want to get into that in a bit. Also, we do have another guest who is on her way down here. I just got a text from her saying she's on her way. Circumstances beyond her control have kept her from being here, but she is going to join us midway, and that is Kim Hall. And Sherry, why don't you give her credentials?
Yes, Kim Hall is from Humboldt State University in the Veterans Center and is a substantial support person for vets on campus.
So thus far, we've had some really wonderful interviews. Colonel Ann Wright, we had a chance to talk with her again after 7 years, and always just a wonderful person to talk to on this topic. Yesterday, we talked to the writer and director of The Invisible War. This documentary has actually changing things in Washington, which is really amazing. I mean, it's got to be quite gratifying as a filmmaker to put something out there that you feel passionate about and have this work actually start making a difference.
I thought that was amazing when Colonel Ann Wright was talking about taking people in Congress to watch that mm-hmm. film, bringing them into the offices and making sure that they watch the film, and that for some folks to say they did not understand about this issue until they saw that film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is truly remarkable. And, you know, having anyone in Congress even talking about it was tough. And now we've got Senator Hillebrand about to put this up before the Senate to vote on taking these military trials out of the hands of the military.
Which there's tremendous resistance to.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's very hard to make those kind of changes in the military. But it's a true conflict of interest. It was very clearly talked about by Kirby Dick yesterday.
Right.
And it absolutely makes sense. I mean, it would never happen in the civilian world, you know, where that kind of conflict of interest would be allowed to go forward in a trial. It just wouldn't have happened.
But the military is its own thing.
It is. And at least fortunately there is talk. there is some movement. There's resistance to that, to changing that, but at least they are looking at more seriously taking this, more seriously rather than sweeping it under the carpet.
I think it's important that those conversations are happening on a national level, because that's part of how we address these issues and change policy. And I think, like what you're saying, Cliff, it's really right. I mean, here locally, like if law enforcement or somebody is accused of sexual assault, it would not be that agency that would be investigating that crime, because absolutely a conflict of interest.
Yes.
So more conversations have to continue to happen.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
that's why I think I'm sorry, this is Maureen. And that's why I think it's so vital that we have a conversation to discuss the culture of the military. I neglected to mention that I'm being treated for PTSD, MST, military sexual trauma, and how that has affected me. But my understanding as an academic of the inside of military culture, I think, is valuable. You know, we talk about how prevalent this problem is, but we don't talk about the culture and why there would be so much resistance to taking, the legal prosecution process outside the military rank structure. And there's good reason for that, and it, that same reason is why it's so difficult and why PTSD is so painful. And it has to do with the fact that at induction, whether officer or enlisted, you know, you're basically stripped of your identity. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you know anything about the theory of identity, you know that it changes. It's about identifying with a culture into which one places oneself. And in the military, you do that willingly, and it's a very marked event that you are stripped down, and you are created into something else, and what you become is a part of a family. And in the same way that molestation has just terrible effects upon someone who is molested and, a victim of parental, abuse, and it alters one's perspective of the world, so too in the military. You are a family member, and to be a whistleblower means that you're excommunicated from that family if you speak about, you know, the unspeakable. And therein lies the problem. So even with all of the processes in place in the military, it's extremely difficult. I mean, I know of an A-10 pilot here on Davis-Monthan where I am, a woman who is just being hounded by the men she works with, and will not speak up. I have a good friend who's a retired colonel out of Texas, whose PTSD symptoms are as bad as mine were, and she will not come forward, married to a retired F-4 Top Gun pilot, and who said to her, even having witnessed everything, said to her, "Can't you just forget about it?" Well, no, I can't. No, I can't.
No, I mean, it makes absolute sense. And, you know, when you talk about that, you know, this, you know, the way that one is brought into the military and essentially stripped of their of who they are. I mean, that is almost a setup for abuse. Fortunately, most of the time it's not. But I mean, the thing is that a door is thrown open and can easily be taken advantage of. When that happens, I mean that happens in, you know, domestic violence cases, you know, where the partner is basically stripped of who they are, and you know they're in the boot camp of that relationship, and basically under control, and
there are a lot of parallels,
and
it's about abuse of power within hierarchy.
Right. Yeah, and the one, trying to find, well, some sensibility about it. I mean, in a command structure, you have people who are in authority and you have people who must obey orders. And that is really conditioned in, or, you know, starting in basic training. So what happens when you have to step outside of that is, I think, a fear that the system itself will collapse. And so that's this tenacious holding on to that hierarchy, and that the people in, at the top know best, and anybody else who's experiencing this. It's like a few bad apple theory. You know, it's not the system itself. It's just a few bad apples.
Well, there's this other overlay, which is of gender identity, and the association between gender and nationalism. Because, you know, historically, the whole notion to be patriotic and defend one's nation was assigned to the male, head of household, you know, nation even as the male entity protecting hearth and home. And so when this shifted, it began to shift when we needed the labor of women that Colonel Wright and Kirby Dick talked about. Suddenly, that there was a threat to core male identity. And so what I tried to study in the interviews that I did with military women was how are they constructing their identity as women within a predominantly male identified culture. And the way that people within the military structure criticize one another most heatedly and with the greatest effect professionally is to call one another unprofessional. And so what I did was I deconstructed, what do they mean by professional? Well, guess what? They mean male.
Mm-hmm.
And so how do women in the military construct themselves, and they do it, believe me, on a day-to-day basis, very carefully self-monitor their behavior in a gendered environment. How do they do that? And you'd be surprised and interested to see what they do. And the moment that they break the rules, the unspoken rules about how to display those things, then harassment begins. And a case in point that I analyze in my upcoming book is the investigation of the resignation of Jackie Parker, who was the first ever F-16 fighter pilot woman with the New York Reserve, and, you know, would fly in formation with guys who were actively trying to diminish her. And she finally resigned and said, you know, my life is in danger. If I cannot trust the guys I'm flying in formation with, I can't fly. And she had more time in the cockpit than her IPs. She was a prodigy, graduated college at 17. The woman was brilliant, and that was her problem.
Now, we've got a change going on in the military, and we all know that although it's not been quote-unquote official, you know, women have played an active combat role for some time now, but it is now part of the official landscape that women are playing active combat roles, are being moved into this and being recruited more. If this culture doesn't shift before that happens, we could be in for a really big problem down the road. Do you see any shifts happening with regard to that?
It, you know, it comes slowly. It's coming so slowly, as Kirby Dix talked about. This has been going on, you know, and Colonel Wright talked about this too. This has been going on for as long as women have been participating. And, you know, Kirby Dix mentioned how men are more often assaulted than women in the military. Well, guess what? That's because women only make up a small percentage of military members.
Of course.
And yeah, so, I mean, I don't think that emphasizing that has any value unless you really take it in context. So I think change is happening, but only because of social forces outside of the military rank structure. We can see even now. You know, here I am at Davis-Monson in Tucson, where Jim Wilkerson was made the wing safety officer for the 12th Air Force, having been convicted of sexual assault and court-martialed, and then forgiven by Lieutenant General Franklin of the 3rd Air Force in Europe. Well, how in the world could that happen in the face of everything that's gone on prior to that? This is a one-year-old case. How can it be so fresh that this general could do such a thing? Well,
that really is
incredible. Those guys know each other. They know each other. They have come up through the ranks together.
And this is that conflict of interest that Kirby Dick was talking about yesterday.
And it's reminiscent. It's reminiscent of the Catholic Church, discovering pedophilia and horrible molestation of vulnerable children, and then moving a priest to another parish.
Right. Well, again, it's the conflict of interest that is going on. Now, where you are, is there a lot of resistance to these kind of trials being taken out of the hands of the military?
I can't really speak to that. I've only read about it in the press, but I know that, you know, within, just as with the priesthood and other contexts, what goes on is that the men in those higher ranks have worked very, very hard to get where they are. And they get that far because they work as a team. That's an inherent value with the military culture.
And that's part of it. You're supposed to work as
a team.
That's
right. So their teammates are these fellows who are doing these things. You know, and as others have said, you know, they're a minority. But when you are standing in a flight suit and looking at another guy that you went to OCS with or whatever, you're not thinking about that. You're not even imagining that it's possible that someone could have, you know, a fetish or, you know, be sick enough to rape. You don't think because you're trained to be acting in integrity, you know, service above self, honesty, integrity. And that's who you are. That's your identity. And so you can't imagine looking at one of your colleagues and guessing that they're guilty, nor could a priest, right? Would, you know, sure. There it is, religion. They all believe that they have a higher purpose. But, in fact, they're human beings, and, you know, across culture, we have people with psychological problems.
Well, therein lies the issue, is that the military is made up of human beings, and, you know, all across the spectrum, we do have, you know, human beings that do this, that do that do rape, that do attack, that do violence to other fellow human beings. And the problem, you know, that's been pointed out now with all these different interviews is that what's inherent in the what the big problem is with this is that there is no checks and balances because the people who are doing the perpetrating are also the same organization that's doing the quote-unquote punishment or investigating it.
And it also adds another layer of victim blaming.
Absolutely.
For a hurdle for a survivor to even acknowledge to themselves that mm-hmm. this is what's happening.
Right. I mean, a lot of people are saying, why is this so inherent in the military? It's inherent in all strata of society.
Exactly.
But there's a mm-hmm. real problem with the way it's dealt with in the military.
Exactly. And that's a really, it's an important point for us to acknowledge and consider that sexism and misogyny, you know, girl and woman hating, I know that sounds strong, you know, it's like, oh, that's too, you know. But when you look at these attitudes, these beliefs, they lead to these behaviors. The name calling of girls and women, the unequal treatment, the damned if you do and damned if you don't kind of circumstances that a lot of girls and women find themselves in, and the pilot, that story was just such exemplary
horrific.
Of that. You know, talent and dedication, sexism is a poison in our culture, in military culture, in religious culture, in all culture. And unless we can call that out and bring that out and name that and increase our awareness about how those attitudes, beliefs lead to these behaviors and actions, we're always going to be talking about what are we doing after the fact.
Absolutely. And the thing is that, I mean, I think if the military brass can step back and say that and look at this, that this would actually strengthen them. It strengthens their hand that, you know, that this level of transparency would be allowed. Take it, you know, if we've done wrong, then, you know, please investigate it outside of our jurisdiction. You know, we want this to be clean. We want this to be good. We want this to be a good, solid organization. I think it makes the military stronger. But at this point, there is still a lot of resistance to that. And that is where Senator Hillebrand's...
You know, I don't think we can imagine. I don't think we have gotten to the point, and may not even soon get to the point, where we can imagine American culture or even Western culture absent of misogyny. And at the same time, you know, we're thinking that we're going to democratize the world and make it safe for all women. I mean, the irony is obvious to anyone who thinks. And, you know, what would that look like? if misogyny was not general practice, was not the assumption, what did that even look like? I don't think any of us fully understand that. But we are at the point now where same-sex marriage is becoming, you know, more accepted, and you know, new ideas about gender are being more accepted. And I think, you know, the military has been the proving ground for a lot of change. You know, the treatment of African Americans, the equality they experienced in the military was prior to the equality they experienced.
This is true.
In the larger culture. And so if that's the case, and if the larger culture is now reflecting an acceptance of the LGBT community and same-sex marriage, then you know, even in the military now, they have same-sex benefits for partners. You know, things are changing, but I don't think that we're really going to ever get to a place where misogyny is not an assumption. I just don't see that happening.
Well, I mean, as we said, you know, the problem is it's, you know, it's prevalent in all strata of society. It's unfortunate. It would be terrific for us to say we want to eliminate this from the human species, and of course we would love to see that happen. Maybe with evolution, it'll happen. But you know, at this point, it's there, and you know, it's how it's dealt with, you know, in the various different parts of society. You know, in civilian society, it's finally being dealt with very harshly and strongly. It hasn't been for a very long time.
Well, we couldn't even name it. Yeah. We didn't even understand what this was, and often internalized it as our own inadequacy or our own weaknesses or our own fault.
Exactly.
You know, this is why it's so amazing, the treatment that I've received out of the VA. I have to tell you, it's amazing because it addresses that sort of unspeakable terror that is, you know, the result of military sexual trauma and any sexual trauma, that cognitive processing therapy has made a huge difference in my life because it has given me an avenue to speak the unspeakable and to give expression to something that I internalized as my own fault and as something I was complicit in. But it's only by talking with someone who objected, and my therapist, believe it or not, was male. And I at first rejected that idea, but he immediately let me know what, believe it or not, what his politics were. And they're liberal. And I said, well, you can stay. And so we kept talking, and what he allowed me to do was put language to what happened to me. But more importantly, the thing about CPT is that he allowed me to put language to what I believe in the duress of that moment about myself that was imprinted within my being and that needed to be excised.
And giving language.
Giving language to put it into the light of day and say, this is not me. This happened to me. This is not me. So, you know, again, it's about identity.
Absolutely. And, of course, in a culture, the military, where giving language to it is frowned upon. You know, talking about it is frowned upon. As you mentioned, it's going against the family. So we've got to take a break and let our sponsors say a few words. But we are going to continue this conversation. And I want to remind folks listening at home that this is also an open conversation, and you are certainly welcome to join in, ask questions, make comments. That's what it's all about. 786-KHUM. That's 786-5486. Again, we don't have a team of operators standing by. It's just me. So if you get a ring, just let it ring until I get a chance to answer. You've got it on KHUM. Okay, we are halfway through the 8 o'clock hour. You've got it on KHUM. And we are in the midst of our 18th Stop the Violence, Start the Healing campaign. And we are dealing with the topic of sexual assault in the military. And again, I want to ask folks if you want to join in this conversation, you certainly are welcome to. Ask questions, make comments, 786-KHUM, 786-5486. Humboldt County's got a very, very large number of families with involvement in the military, so this was an appropriate topic to bring up. Also in the fact that this is getting a lot of attention as of late. So let's go around the room introducing, I'm Cliff, of course, from KHUM. Sherry?
Sure. Sherry Johnson, mm-hmm. and I am the Director of Field Education in the Department of Social Work at Humboldt State University and the Chair of the Humboldt County Domestic Violence Coordinating Council.
Marianne?
I'm Marianne with the North Coast Rape Crisis Team.
Okay. We've also we've got another guest who is on her way after a delay, but she is definitely coming, and that is Kim Hall.
And I think she might even just be pulling up, unless that's just a neighbor.
It could be. And joining us from Tucson, Arizona, via telephone, we've got Maureen Phillips. Hello, Maureen.
Captain Maureen Phillips. Even though you're retired, we still refer to you as Captain?
Yeah, some people do. I use that, you know, in my signature line. I am.
But also, we could refer to you as Doctor as well.
Yeah, I kind of like that one. I worked as hard on that.
Right.
There you go. Yes. Anyway, we were talking a little bit off air. We wanted to make sure, because we've gone down some sophisticated paths, we wanted to just kind of bring it back for our listeners to be fully clear of what we're talking about. And so, Sherry, you want to touch on that?
Well, I was going to ask Marianne to help us maybe mm-hmm. define sexualized violence a little bit and sexualized sexual assault and sort of these different terms that are used and it's sexual trauma.
And because I guess one thing that we hear is sexual, sex, rape. This is all about sex, but really, this is correct me if I'm wrong. This is all about violence.
It's every bit about violence and power and control, like's been said here earlier. That's the dynamic of it. And I think it's really important to identify that any sexual contact without clear consent, and that's part of our rape culture in this country, is not really identifying with what consent is. And I think that's part of what plays into the whole victim blaming. So it's any kind of sexual contact, and that's what's so challenging for a lot of survivors, because the mechanics of the sex is there like consensual sexual activity, but the actual feelings and impactfulness of it are polarized, because one's about loving someone and intimacy, and the other is about violence and power and control. And that's what I really appreciate being spoken here about, is the need to reframe that, because a lot of survivors, whether they can find their voice to report or not, get really tangled up in that dynamic and do a lot of victim blaming about it, because of all these intersections that we're talking about, sexism, racism, all those things intersect and really impact sexual assault and the survivors and them trying to really figure out what happened to me. We often get calls on the crisis line. It's like, what is this? Really, because it's so – the betrayal that we're talking about here, like I really appreciate the analogies of incest in the family and also with the clergy, that authority figure, those when you're programmed to be in these very intimate and dependent relationships, and then you add the dynamic of sexualized violence to that, it's very devastating and totally confusing, and it's crazy making. So trying to really identify for the survivor themselves what exactly has happened is a challenge in itself.
It's such an abuse of power.
Please continue.
Maureen, did you?
I really love that last point about helping people to come out of the shadows. It's quite a challenge. And, you know, one of the ways that I think is most effective, I'm an English professor. I've been teaching people how to write arguments for years. And I always tell my students the most persuasive argument comes from the person with the least amount of stake in the issue. So more men coming forward and advocating for justice in this area is what we need. and to invite women to speak, to say, I trust your perspective on this, I am willing to listen to you, and I will help you in any way that I can, is like, you know, a white person in the 1960s being involved in the march on Birmingham. It speaks volumes. Advocacy invites people out of that shadow, but it's very, very difficult because there are other threats to speaking that are too painful. And, you know, for me, I had a male advocate in the form of Major General Frank Scoggins, who was the Washington Air National Guard commander, continues to be a friend of mine. And a year ago, when I went into the VA hospital for my PTSD, he advocated for me, and it changed the game for everybody involved because he was a major general. It's in my health record. He knows what happened, and he spoke up. Now, did he have any gain in that? No. I mean, that is a good man. That's a good officer.
What's the right thing to do?
It's the right thing to do, and we need more men in the military to stand up and say, we know what this is. And I have male friends in the military who say to me, oh, yeah, Maureen, we see it. We know what you're talking about. I had a good friend say to me, you know what, those guys make it really hellish for the rest of us.
I absolutely agree. And the thing is that, you know, one thing that you mentioned a little earlier is the culture that, of course, you know, the culture is you know, we're a family. You know, we got each other's backs. We never go against each other. I think it actually strengthens the military, as I mentioned before, if this is called out. I think the culture of, you know, we're a family, we got each other's backs, is good unless that is being abused. I really think that a new layer of that needs to be put on there. It's like, we got each other's backs, we never go against each other, so long as you don't go against us.
Well, I mean, the code of silence. Mm-hmm. I mean, like in a police are another example of that kind of culture where you don't say anything contrary about another officer. And then breaking the silence, I mean, talking about sexual assault, sexualized violence is taboo still. It's really hard to talk about it. And then when you add the overlay of the enforced code of silence, I mean, you're really asking a survivor to really step forward into the unknown, and already dealing with the consequences of the assault. And the thing is, too, this get over it, I wanted to just circle back really quickly to that. Mm-hmm. The Adverse Childhood Experiences Study, Vincent Felitti out of San Diego, Kaiser Permanente, a sample of 17,000 people talked about their early adverse child experiences, including sexual abuse and physical abuse and emotional abuse and parent issues and watching their dad beat their mom and a dad or a mom in jail or a caregiver in jail or prison. So you could have a score of 7. And a lot of people with a score of 4 or more had severe social and health consequences as a result of their adverse childhood experiences. They did not get over it. And many of them died early. So this isn't...
And, you know, the colonel, the female colonel I mentioned in Texas, has gone through a cancer and chemo and everything, and her health has really been affected. But you know what she said? She said, you know, instead of my 25-year career, you know, she made 06. This is an amazing woman. Instead of my narrative about my career being that I was a commander, the only female commander in the Iraqi War Theater, that I was an ace air traffic controller. The narrative about my military is how I survived this. It's not, it changes how you talk about yourself. And so, you know, speaking about it means that it shifts the association that others have with your service or with your ties to that family. The story about you becomes, well, she's the one who told on dad. Mm-hmm. Or, right? Mm-hmm. And so instead of she is the daughter of a loving family, she is the, right? So the risk is great. And I didn't want my conversation, the narrative I have about my career, to not be about intelligence gathering, for which I worked very, very hard. But it is. And I'm powerless against that. but it is. My narrative is about how I survived military sexual trauma.
Speaking of which, and because we've all heard that it is very, very hard for you know, people who have experienced this, well, just in the civilian world, it's hard to come forward, but in the military, much harder. If you are willing to share, if you could tell us the experience, what it was like for you to finally come forward, and what you experienced, and how you finally decided to do that.
I'll try. I was afraid you were going to ask me that.
And Maureen, you do not have to talk about this.
If you don't want to.
No, you do not have to.
Well, let me tell you what happened after everything that was bad. I had an education beyond my Air Guard career to be a college professor. And my PTSD derailed that career, and I didn't even know what was happening. But I was very, very angry, and I suffered depression and an eating disorder. And these are very typical, what are they called, comorbidities of PTSD. I did not know what I did not know until someone describes me as a patient with post-traumatic stress disorder, military sexual trauma. And then they said, eventually you're going to have to talk about this, but you're only going to do it in a framework of healing. And they told me that as early as 07, and I was not willing. I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it. I couldn't even publish a book out of my own dissertation, which was a study of women in the military, because I would go catatonic. And most people who know me realize the irony there, but I couldn't do it. And my family has picked me up and picked me up and picked me up. The people I love suffer when I suffer. And the people who love me. So when this finally happened to the point where I had literally lost everything, and I ended up, like so many veterans, without a home, I had gone through my savings and was ready literally to take my own life. I finally said, okay, I'll go in the hospital. So I did. And that began CPT and my introduction to a way out. I didn't know what was wrong with me. I kept blaming myself, saying, you know, I'm really a loser. I don't know why I'm so angry all the time. Why do I get depressed? You know, why do I engage in addictive eating? Well, I was trying everything I could, not to talk about it. And you can't do that. So it took me to the brink, and I was emaciated by the time I went into the VA hospital. And, you know, here's the funny thing. They only let me stay there 8 days because I was so angry that I made it too hard for the other women, the other seven women who were in the, you know, the cohort I was in.
Yeah.
And then it was like, you're on your own, which is, you know, there's a congressional investigation about that right now because they put me out on the street from the VA hospital. And I damn near died. But that's how angry I was. I mean, you couldn't have a conversation with, and I'm not the only one, you know. I mean, that's what I understand now, is that this is very typical of people who have just been pummeled to their core. And so it's only a year since that's happened. In fact, this month, on November 8th, it was a year since that happened. So
wow.
I'm rising very slowly from the ashes, and I'm speaking, as you can tell.
Well, I'll tell you what, Your speaking is empowering mm-hmm. a lot of people because, I mean, the thing is, for every one person that, you know, that does decide to do what you did, which is brave and tough, there are lots who don't or suffering silently. And, you know, you're willing to talk about it will influence others. It will help others. And as painful as it is for you, you've really helped a lot of others, I think.
Let me tell you why I do it. A psychologist at the VA, a woman psychologist, told me that asked me if I had ever read Viktor Frankl's book, Man's Search for Meaning. Mm-hmm. And I imagine people in the room there know about that book. I had never heard of it. But, you know, Frankl was a psychologist and was a was in the concentration camps in Germany, and he studied the behavior of the people who survived and then thrived when, you know, after the war was over, and discovered that the people who had purpose outside of themselves were the ones who thrived. Now, at the time that this psychologist recommended that I read that book, I was unable to read, and I have a PhD in English. That's how bad I was. But I got it on audio tape from the library, and it utterly shifted the globe on its axis for me, because I realized that what I had to do was, I mean, you know, I was going around saying, do you need something? Let me do it for you. Because I found out that if I had a purpose outside of myself, I suddenly felt redeemed. There was that part of myself that said there's value in my being on the planet if someone needs me. And so what I did was I went and volunteered, and I'm now volunteering with three organizations related to veterans. And I tell everyone who will listen, who is suffering with this, find someone else that you can share your experience with, share some strength with, and give them some hope that they too can, you know, that there's a welcoming community meeting them, and that their personhood matters. And that's where I began.
Fantastic. And you were mentioning at the beginning of the broadcast that writing a book as well.
I am. I'm going to do this thing by hook or by crook. I'm going to share, you know, the important information in what I already wrote in the dissertation in book form about, you know, the culture and why it is. It just loops back around upon itself and why it can't seem to get out of, you know, this perpetual cycle and, you know, the reality that their prosecution is virtually non-existent within the culture against military sexual assault. So, yeah, I hope, you know, and actually, because I had to leave academe, I'm actually now owner of a consulting business with which I coach doctoral dissertation writers through their projects. So I have found good purpose there. Yeah, I mean, you know, purpose will find its way if you're seeking purpose, mm-hmm. and I'm really, really grateful for that, and for this opportunity, by the way.
Well, we are extremely grateful that Dr. Jen McGuire found you and then connected us. And so we just appreciate how the universe works to bring people together and to have voices heard that can change everything, just everything.
And I can't appreciate you enough for sharing your courage and your struggle, because I've seen and heard that assisting so many survivors, of knowing that, yes, it's this amazing, intense struggle, and yet in you're finding your hope and your courage, and you're sharing that with others, and that's very, very inspirational. I so appreciate your telling your truth.
And also, too, Dr. Maureen, it occurred to me, too, that how our body symptoms, you know, the anger, the depression, the eating disorder, which is very common around sexual abuse, eating disorder, or disordered eating, that our bodies are trying to help us, because we've silenced ourselves. The culture silenced us. We don't want to talk about it because it is just too unbelievably painful. It is unspeakable. And then our bodies, our psyches say, no, we need to heal. Our inclination, our homeostatic inclination, is to find balance and to be healed. And so those symptoms, instead of us being upset that we have them, we're grateful that we have them, because it can get us the help that we need.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I just encourage any woman veteran or male veteran listening to this program to go to the VA and get the help to get out of the silence and into healing, because it can happen rather quickly when you realize that it's by serving and helping other people. And, you know, it's been an amazing miracle, and I just would encourage any veteran listening to this radio program to realize that there is help available, and you don't have to stay hurting.
Absolutely. And on that note, I think we need to take a quick break and let our sponsors say a few words. I want to remind you that you're listening to KHUM. It's our Stop the Violence, Start the Healing campaign. It's our 18th here on KHUM, and this week we've dedicated it to sexual assault in the military, military sexual trauma. We've had several terrific interviews thus far, all archived at KHUM.com. Just click on the Stop the Violence page. And right now we are about to wrap up our first hour of 2 hours focusing on this topic. It's been riveting, some amazing sharing thus far. And I want to remind you that this is also an open community conversation, and you are certainly welcome to call in, ask questions, make comments. 786-KHUM, 786-5486. That is the number. We'll be right back. And our Stop the Violence, Start the Healing campaign continues. Again, we are dealing with sexual assault in our own military. And during the break, we were chatting a little bit about trauma itself. And who wants to grab that?
Well, I think we want to help our listening audience understand that trauma comes in lots of different manifestations. So sometimes anger is there. Other times a lack of feeling at all, like a lack of emotional connection.
Kind of you were saying, sometimes people can say, obviously I'm not having trauma, I'm not feeling anything.
Yeah, a disassociation.
I think it's really important to name all those things because everybody has their own way of surviving. And for some people, maybe the intense violence and brutality that they've experienced in their lives, they can't even touch the anger. And so they... And what we've been talking about is also trying to avoid or repress any feelings. That takes a whole lot of energy on our body, and therefore, you know, being really depressed, not being able to get up, not being able to function at all because you have no will to engage in life because your whole body is trying to suppress all the really, really intense emotions. And things like people... reliving the trauma. And we take in trauma, you know, physically and emotionally and cognitively and sometimes spiritually. And so if it's affecting all those different layers, it's going to manifest in lots of different ways. And I think that, you know, like people not being able to sleep, having night terrors, having those recurrent images, and not just visual images of the trauma, but physical sensations of the trauma. And there are all these little puzzle pieces separated that makes it challenging for that person to know what's going on. They could feel like they're just losing their mind because all of a sudden they have a physical sensation, but maybe no visual or cognitive connection to that, you know, and it can be maddening for them.
I can describe for you what it's like to have PTSD if you'd like.
Yes,
please do.
You know, someone helped me to understand it in the beginning myself by telling me that he said, you know, if the average person sees a commercial airliner going by up in the sky, they say, oh, those lucky people are on their way to vacation. I wonder where that plane's headed. Someone with PTSD looks at it and says that plane is about to explode and we'll have body parts falling on us at any minute. And that is the, you know, the nanosecond impulse that happens when your brain is riddled, you know, with PTSD symptoms. The other thing I wanted to say was that, you know, we knew during the time that I was in uniform, we knew what was going on. We had a wing commander commit suicide because of the sex scandal. We had squadron commanders who were taken out of, you know, relieved of duty because of their treatment of women. We knew what was happening. I did not know that it affected me internally, and I didn't know, I assumed that it was pointless to talk about it, because what's going to happen anyway? Mm-hmm. I'll get more, mm-hmm. more pain, right?
And that's we tell ourselves there's nothing, nothing we can do.
There's nothing we can do. What's the point? You know, mm-hmm. what's the point? But that's why this, you know, Viktor Frankl book is so key for me. Anyway, it might not be true for everyone, but I think it's so valuable because the other person that you're trying to help, you know, certainly receives that help and enjoys that and everything. But what happens is, you know, there's this increase in endorphins and there's a sense of purpose. And so to answer the question, why should I speak out? Why should I take any action? Ends up being, the answer becomes, because you can return to personhood if you do. And you can associate with other people. You can find intimacy again. And, you know, that was my problem, was that I was flat. I was a flat liner when it came to intimacy. I was unavailable. Didn't even know it. So I love it when people talk about this because it helps me, you know, as I'm continuing to understand the implication of this. But that whole idea of why should I speak out, there's nothing that can be done anyway, keeps a lot of people locked inside themselves, looking up at the airplane and waiting for it to explode. And that, you know, that one of the symptoms of PTSD is that you have either trouble sleeping or trouble falling asleep and staying asleep. For me, when I go to sleep at night, I have to be listening to an audio tape or music, even sometimes not even music, or watching a video on Hulu or something. And then I'll fall asleep and, you know, at some point turn it off in the middle of the night. But in the morning, when the plane exploding thoughts appear in my head upon consciousness, I mean, one morning it was seeing someone thrown into a wood chipper. Another morning it was seeing a baby banged up against a tree. I mean, they just appear unbidden. And I think, you know, before I knew what that was, I thought, I'm a psychotic. What the hell? Yeah. But now I know I need to get up out of that bed and not linger there. And as I start my day and I begin with meditation, oftentimes exercise, it changes it. And at least now I can put language and I can say, that's a PTSD thought. That is not me.
Right. And we can also understand that so many people choose sort of problematic substance use or the use of alcohol and other drugs to really distinguish or try to extinguish the continuous pain.
Dull it down.
So it's really a coping, and then of course it can bring its own set of problems as a result, so that you deal with the consequences of the alcohol and other drug abuse as opposed to the original source of the wound. So, but a lot of people cope that way, and we need to reach out to people who are vets who have these kinds of issues and know that there are resources and there is help for that too, because simultaneously, eventually you're going to get to the PTSD stuff.
Absolutely. I should mention this is KHUM, Cutton, Eureka, Arcata, and Manila, and translator K2828D Eureka, streaming on the web at khum.com. It's our Stop the Violence, Start the Healing campaign. You know, the one of the things that that you talked about was inability to sleep and the nightmares. I've also seen it manifest itself in excessive sleep. You know, people sleeping for, mm-hmm. you know, 15, 20 hours at a time. It's like that's a sign something's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
It's, again, a coping, a body trying to cope. You know, just shut down.
Right.
Shut down. Right. And it's, as you know, we're all mentioning, it just manifests in so many different ways. The mm-hmm. body has so many different ways of coping with trauma. One other methodology that I've seen is really kind of denial of the entire thing, rationalizing it, putting it into a different perspective, changing the circumstances of what actually happened. You know, this was not an attack. This was, trying to change the truth in someone's head to just to as a coping mechanism.
Right. And avoidance as well, too. And depending upon how much trauma the person has experienced and all the triggers around that, again, there can be a whole lot of avoidance of a lot of different things, and then that could be another kind of shutdown, you know. Mm-hmm.
Another strange one that I have seen is excessive happiness, manicness. You know, mm-hmm. people are just like, just always in a good mood, no matter what. I mean, it's like no one's in a good mood always. What's going on? You know, it's again, a cover-up,
mm-hmm.
a way of masking what's there.
It's, you know, one symptom that I had after the stuff that happened to me that I never realized was related to is claustrophobia and hypervigilance. Hypervigilance is something that is, you know, more commonly understood associated with PTSD, but claustrophobia mimics the feeling that I felt when I was in the midst of what was happening to me and I couldn't escape.
Can't breathe.
And, yeah, I couldn't, you know, if I get into a small, like I couldn't get into the backseat of someone's van or something like that because there's no quick exit. Mm-hmm. I have to sit by the door. I have to face the door. And if, you know, I got to get out of here. I got to get out of here. Like, I will run over you to get out of here kind of feeling. And it's this panicky, something I didn't know was a part of the PTSD. And then the hypervigilance, you know, it's just this shoulders up all the time, what's going on here kind of feeling. But, you know, who could blame someone for wanting to numb a life lived with those symptoms?
Right.
Any way possible.
And I think that's part of why it's so important that we're talking about all these things, because everybody has their own way that they're needing to cope with it. And sometimes we choose healthier ways than other ways. But to acknowledge that that's the way to move through the healing, and there isn't a only right way or wrong way to do it. It's trying to listen to oneself and find our way through the healing.
But you know, you described so poignantly, Dr. Marine, what happened to you, and that, and for us to realize that that vets are taking their lives at a rate greater than the loss in the two, you know, so-called wars, there's something really wrong, and that is an outcome in terms of the pain is so great that, and you feel like I cannot live, you know, because I think a lot of folks without untreated out without intervention are just like, I'm just going to live with this until I don't, and then they can't. So that's why it's so life-saving to have this conversation, and for you to speak your truth and to share that is enormously helpful.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, you know, whether it's the result, you know, the PTSD is the result of combat wound, combat, you know, stress, or sexual trauma, I have to say, you know, there are some very, very fine Americans who are willing to defend our country. And our country is worth defending. You know, freedom really does matter. And I'm willing to speak for that reason, too. That those people don't should be told that, you know, we value them. We value their being a part of our culture. And they need to know that. And, you know, they've been inspired because they believe in America.
Absolutely. You know, one of the things, you know, that you just mentioned, of course, is that, you know, the reason, and it's an all-voluntary military at this point, you know, the reason that people would volunteer is because they do feel that way. And to have something like this happen is such a betrayal of trust. I mean, it just turns one's world completely upside down when that betrayal happens.
And that there is... Go ahead, Dr. Marine.
That's right.
No, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, you know, after Vietnam, we knew that Vietnam vets, part of the conflict they were experiencing was the dichotomy between, you know, the fact that they risked everything,
right,
including their lives. They saw awful things in a war that was unsupported by the American people. And likewise, in this, you know, forgive me for getting all political on you, but the Iraqi and Afghani wars, they're not about freedom. They're about oil. They're about maintaining, you know, American hegemony. And do you think that the average American service member doesn't know that? The purpose of the war matters.
So
it matters.
And that is, you know, and I think it speaks to the exploitative nature of all of the kind of sexual assault and violence and abuse that we're talking about, that using people people of color using women in a way as objects for greed and gratification is at a micro level and a macro level. And when we when we can really look at the culture and say we as a people on earth do not want to tolerate that, and so we have to start the long hard work of naming it, increasing our awareness of it, of finding our allies, developing strategies, addressing it in any way that we can, wherever we can, that we have a right as a human being here on earth to do that.
I agree.
So one thing I want to take a look at is Senator Kirsten Gillibrand of New York is putting a bill out there that would essentially, basically the concept is that, and this has gotten bipartisan support, which is kind of exciting, that would finally take these trials out of the military's hands and put them into a court where there is not a conflict of interest. And this is important because this is, you know, as we've talked about, you know, we talked about at the beginning of this conversation, and we talked about with, you know, both Kirby Dick and with Colonel Ann Wright, is that that conflict of interest just is such a problem with getting these trials, getting any justice out of these things. And you know, the fact this is being brought up, it is exciting to think that this is going to it's being voted on in just a few weeks, I think, and hopefully, I mean, if assuming it will pass the Senate, I've got my fingers crossed that it can also get through the hurdle in the House, which is always a challenge, but we will see what happens.
Right, and even just having the conversation and talking about it and people having the awareness that this is an issue. And according to Ms. Gillibrand, it undermines the credibility of the greatest military force in the world. So there's a reason that everyone should get behind this and to really truly show support for our veterans and for our active military service. This is a way to ensure safety so that no one has to experience this again. Kim Hall is here. Yay. Welcome.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm surprised I still get lost after living here my entire life.
So, Kim, thank you for making it better a little late than never, and we do appreciate you coming. Introduce yourself to the audience, please.
Absolutely. My name is Kim Hall, and I run the Veterans Program at Humboldt State University. I've been at Humboldt since 1984, and I started that program back in 89, and we've built it up to a place where we have programming for our veterans, and we serve all needs. So they come through our office for admissions, through graduation and career academic advising, and we also have a transition program. So transition is a lot to do with mental health and making that move from wherever they're coming from, whether it be the civilian world or if they're coming directly out of a combat zone or out of the military. We have a program that's an outdoor program that helps them move into student life a little more easy.
So, Kim, have you been listening to our conversation up to this point?
I have, absolutely.
Excellent, good. any thoughts that you want to add on any of the conversation we've had thus far?
So my perspective is that as the point of contact at Humboldt State with the veterans there, most of the vets there are 20-somethings, right? They come in and they're ready to move on with their life. They've served their time and they've gotten out and they're ready to move on through their education and ultimately to their career and employment. So the journey to coming to grips with what's going on with them in terms of their mental health is a long journey because they're still moving. They're still moving through their life in terms of getting past, you know, separating out of the military into student life. And so that transition, if you will, is a huge process. And so I moved through that journey with them in terms of listening to their stories and talking to them about, you know, that it's not normal to not sleep for nights on ends. And it's not normal to have what we all can put a term to, which is hypervigilance, right? But for them, it's survival.
I created a lecture and delivered it at Western Oregon University about how college professors should prepare to teach veterans with post-traumatic stress disorders and TBIs, and what they need to understand if, you know, because there are going to be more and more veterans coming to the university campuses as the drawdown takes place. And so I'd love to come to HSU and present the same lecture to the faculty there. It was very well received and turned on some lights for folks, especially when I shared that, you know, I am one. And I don't look like one, you know. And, you know, I mention that because I think there does need to be information shared with faculty members about how to help their veteran students.
Absolutely. That's a really good point. We, as an office, myself and some of my students have done presentations in the classroom in the past that is really basic. It comes from, you know, what is military culture and what is okay to say to a veteran and not to say. And it really is about bringing awareness to who that student is that's sitting next to you in a classroom and the conversations that are taking place. And so what you're talking about is an exceptional need, if you will, on educational campuses.
And I just want to, TBI is traumatic brain injury, just in case somebody didn't know that. And there is an enormous number of veterans now living with traumatic brain injury. And so let's make that happen. I mean, Cliff teaches at HSU. I'm at HSU. Kim's at HSU. Dr. Marine, let's make that happen. That would be incredible. And you mentioned, too, in terms of another strategy for recovery was meditation. And we know that now there is an incredible amount of information about how helpful mindfulness practice is for trauma recovery. And we actually start many of our classes with a mindfulness exercise to get us all present and ready to go. And I have seen dramatic changes in myself and in our students when we start our classes that way.
You know, when Dr. McGuire told me that you did that at HSU, I said, "Shut up, you're lying." I mean, that is revolutionary. Fantastic.
We actually have the Institute for Student Success. We're doing our first veteran seminar. I believe it's January 16th. I'd have to check that date.
I was just thinking about that. That would be a perfect opportunity.
Mm-hmm. So we have myself, Angela Rich, who's in diversity and inclusion, and who's also a female veteran. And then I've asked another one of our male student veterans in the Masters of Social Work program to come and present with us.
Right. Do we have a keynote speaker for that already, do you know, for the January?
I don't know.
Okay. Yeah. Well, at any rate, Dr. Marine, we're gonna make that happen. You know. So.
Well, I would be so honored to do that. I'd be very happy. It sounds like you have an amazing program, Kim.
Thank you. Yes, I am quite proud of it. We just returned from Sacramento a couple of days ago for a presentation that we did for the state legislators on the veterans programs, not just at Humboldt, but across the CSU. The Chancellor's Office made a real commitment back in 2006. They called Troops to College program, and the commitment was ultimately success for our veterans and our service members on our campuses. And I believe if we keep the motivation going, that we'll probably lead this country in that.
Fantastic.
Oh, it sounds like it, for sure.
Mm-hmm. All right, before we get too far behind, we're going to have to take a quick break. Let our sponsor say a few words. 18 minutes after 9 o'clock, you've got it on KHUM. This is our Stop the Violence, Start the Healing campaign here on KHUM. And we are wrapping up the week's topic of sexual assault in the military, military sexual trauma. And we've got our roundtable. We got about 45 minutes left. So this is, again, an open community conversation. If you've got any thoughts you would like to share, any questions you have of this good panel of experts, by all means, call 786-KHUM at 786-5486. I should also mention, if you don't want to go on the air, you can certainly just email studio@khum.com. All right, you've got it on KHUM, and our Stop the Violence, Start the Healing campaign continues, and we're going to start this part of it with a caller who would prefer to remain anonymous, and I'm absolutely fine with that. Hey, you're on the air.
Hi. My first marriage had domestic violence in it. I feel guilty like it was my fault. It was a man who was in the military service, and he did things like he took me to church concerts and things like that, and so I thought he was a good person. But the week before we got married, he beat me, and I didn't know how to cancel the marriage. After we were married, I was pregnant, and I had to leave him because I was afraid he was going to kill my child in my body.
Wow.
Second problem I had was a man who went to Vietnam, and he came back, but we stayed together for over a decade because he just lost control of himself sometimes, and he did domestic violence counseling with me, so I stayed with him until he refused to do counseling with me, but now we're like the best of friends, and he would, if I had an emergency, he would come up here and he would help me. And this is all because of counseling that made a difference in our lives. The third problem I had, I don't even know if I want to talk about it this week or not. It's kind of, I almost died a couple years ago. When my car wasn't working, someone gave me a ride, but it has nothing to do with the military. And I was without my car working, getting a ride, and I was tried to get out of his car, and he tried to drive away, and he drove across the Miranda Bridge, and I jumped out of his car window, and he turned around and shot me with a gun.
Wow.
And I've been doing recovery ever since then. But that had nothing to do with the military, because military people, to save their marriages, do counseling sometimes, and they have stress from war, post-traumatic stress disorder from war, and now I listed as having post-traumatic stress disorder, but it was entirely different. It was some pot grower problem in the southern Humboldt that got me shot and almost killed.
Well, you can get PTSD from any trauma. Yeah. It does not have to be from the military. There's all kinds of ways to wind up with that.
I do. Your taxes saved my life. I do mental therapy, physical therapy. I work with the State Department of Rehabilitation, go back to work, and I'm going to college at the Redwoods right now with my grandchildren's generation.
And what you're talking about is whether, I mean, you're talking about a history of trauma, and that is very, very common. And it's unfortunate, and it's terrible, and it shouldn't happen. But when we have one traumatic event, we can have ways of coping and ways of living, and also just out of nowhere have another traumatic event and another traumatic
event.
And
learning from my mistakes, though, because I don't want to have a victim personality, and being able to put decades in between my traumas.
Mm-hmm. And I guess I would want to say is that the people who chose to do violence on you, was their choice of violence, and I'm thankful hearing that at least one of those people reached out for assistance, but in no way did you cause that violence to happen on you. Those are the choices that those people made.
But I have to not put myself in the wrong place at the wrong time, so I don't go out after dark unless I have to. And I make sure my door is locked at night. Even if I wake up in the middle of the night, I'll go lock my doors. And I don't have a listed phone number. And I don't give out my name and address and personal information to people if I don't have to. So I live, you know, I don't use fear against myself. I say that I'm using, if I lived without fear, I would just be out here and have another trauma this year, and I'm saying, no, I'm going to learn from my experiences and put as much time in between this last trauma and hopefully never have another trauma of this sort. I want to believe that I've reached the end of trauma.
It's so important to realize that you did not cause that.
But, you know, the conditions of the world are really frightening, the way people... I work with homeless people. I work with disabled people as a volunteer. I feel sorry for new adults because they're out here where parents can close the door on them when they're 18 and they're in the street with or without a job, being able to go to college or not being able to go to college. And it's frightening for new adults. But in the military service, when people had to go to Vietnam, and we're lucky that people didn't have to go to Afghanistan. They were not drafted to Afghanistan. My son-in-law went to draft Afghanistan, and he came back. He said that the streets here are worse than the streets in Afghanistan because there's control there, and here the streets are out of control. Even though we have law enforcement, I feel so sorry for the law enforcement people because actually they saved my life, and I went to court and I put somebody in jail for 10 years for trying to take my life away. He wanted to rape, beat, and kill me when my car wasn't working and I got a ride. I thought I was getting a ride home and getting some help, and it didn't happen. He went to jail. He's getting out next year, but he's not allowed back in the county because I went and I did some victim program office special paper signing saying he can't be back in Humboldt County.
Sounds like work with a victim witness.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, really appreciate you, you know, taking the time to, you know, come on and share with us. I know it's not easy to.
Yeah. That's why I'm doing it anonymously and saying that, you know, I'm really glad that this is something that people can talk about sometimes. And you take care.
All righty. Thank you again for calling. We do appreciate that.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. All righty. So, I know Maureen, she couldn't hear you too much. Your phone's a little quieter. But I know you were mentioning that you were saying what Marianne was saying also, that it's not her fault. She is not the one who brought it on.
Right, and you know the perception that if you change your behavior, you can avoid other traumas. There's something really, I can relate to that entirely. But I also know that my thinking is skewed when I go there, and. That's hypervigilance. Mm-hmm. You know, that's like, you know, tiptoeing through the world in case someone else wants to assault you is not a way to live. That's PTSD.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people struggle with that because they're wanting to find some sense of control and a why. And we can't answer the perpetrator's why. And so it's really, it is a struggle that I see a lot of people where if I should have, could have, would have done something differently, then this wouldn't have happened to me. Rather than connecting with the truth that person chose to do violence and I had no control over their behavior. And that's a scary truth, but it is important to unravel those ways that we can blame ourselves for the trauma other people commit on us.
You know, there's also this principle that, you know, you can't unsee what you see. And in essence, I saw evil and I can't unsee it. Mm-hmm. And what to do, you know, what to do with that now. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, for me, you know, that's why the meditation and that woman described volunteering, and I'm sure that is a balm to her spirit. Mm-hmm. Because I would, you know, I want to linger where there's goodness and seek it out and even create it. Mm-hmm. Because I have seen evil.
Great.
You know, I was reading an article one time. It was talking about, it was kind of a different twist on PTSD, in that the skills that you learn while you're in the service and or in the combat zone to survive, the skills such as hypervigilance and being aware of your surroundings, when you take those skills that serve you so well in the military and you get discharged and you come out in the civilian world and you're still using those skills to quote-unquote survive, now you have a disorder, right? And so
yeah.
It's very complicated to have those conversations with veterans that, you know, that those skills that they've held on to so closely that, you know, in some instances kept them alive, aren't serving them as well now.
So they're trained in.
That's right.
Right. Right.
That's right. Yeah, and that's one area where the work that Kim is doing is so important, because veterans need to understand that this transition, you know, they're called reintegration programs, are being founded all across the country for veterans to understand that they are going to live by different principles now. So, you know, in the civilian culture, if they arrive, you know, acting like a master sergeant or a, you know, a major, you know, they're going to get a different response. And to help them really become aware is a very important aspect of the work that Kim's office and others like hers do.
I wanted to make sure that we acknowledge the tremendous veterans organizations here in Humboldt County that any veteran could call and seek assistance from, in the Redwood Vet Center, in Henderson Center in Eureka, and the Vets Clinic over by the old mall, and North Coast Veterans Resource Center. I mean, there are resources, and I'm sure Kim's program would be open to talk to anybody who wanted to return to school. And I think taking the proactive action of seeking support and talking about what's happened is the very, very first step in a long, hard process, but it leads to the other side.
Of course, and things like our North Coast stand down, which just happened, of course, last month, a big thing for the veterans community here. We may have lost Maureen, you there?
Yep.
She was saying that there was a chance that we would lose her at some point in the conversation, but perhaps this is her calling. So let's see. Let's try that. Push this button here. Hello, you're on the air.
It's Maureen.
Ah, there you are.
Yay!
I was hoping that would be you calling back.
Great.
You know what? A C-130 just passed overhead, and it messes with my cell phone coverage. Sorry about that.
It's a conspiracy.
It's cool that you know the kind of plane it was.
They're trying to silence you. Very good. Yeah, we were just talking about different veteran services here. A lot of really wonderful ones here on the North Coast, and we were just last month had our North Coast stand down, which was a wonderful, I believe, 3-day event. And there are so many services for vets here, and it's, as I said, we've got a pretty large population of families in the military here in Humboldt County. And that's one of the reasons we're dealing with this topic right now.
You know, I'm typical as a veteran in the sense that it's a generational thing in my family. I have no less than 5 family members associated with the military, beginning with my grandfather, who flew open cockpit aircraft doing reconnaissance during World War One, and my dad, my brother's a retired C-130 pilot, which is why I know what they sound like. My son is in the Air National Guard and is an air traffic controller. And, you know, I come from a blue-collar family, and that is where most military members are drawn from in the larger culture. You know, it's a place for work. Colonel Wright was talking about, you know, escaping small-town America. You know, you join the military to see the world. In fact, you know, that's the advertising.
This is definitely small-town America here.
Yeah, but it's a great town. I can really tell that. Anyway, you know, the veterans in Humboldt County are largely, you know, rural. I know jobs are scarce in the rural communities across the country. And so the impetus is there, you know, to sign up. And there are great advantages. And these vet programs, you know, when I left the military, as you can well imagine, I practically burned my uniform. I did keep my size 4 combat boots. And I did keep my service cap, but everything else went. And I never looked back until I had to. But now I'll tell you, there's so many benefits that I enjoy, including, you know, the respect that I receive at, you know, the VA hospital and at mm-hmm. the centers, that make me feel like I'm really valued. And it took me a long time. Like, if someone says to me, thank you for your service, which happens, you know, pretty regularly, I choke up really fast mm-hmm. because you're just not supposed to say to accept thanks for something. You're just in this quandary emotionally mm-hmm. when someone says thank you for your service, because, you know, you want to say you're welcome, but, you know, that's egotistical and you don't know what to say. But when you get involved with the vet centers and you get involved with volunteering and everything, kind of, you know, ameliorates that feeling of, you know, don't put any attention on me. I didn't do it for thanks. I did it out of patriotism. It's kind of a quandary, you know. But I just wanted to say that any veteran, and most veterans, by the way, don't realize their benefits. And women veterans do not think of themselves as veterans. It's the strangest phenomenon. And, you know, we see, you know, guys in the American Legion smoking cigarettes, you know, with baseball caps. But, in fact, there are women's conferences, women veteran conferences, and all sorts of events to draw these women veterans who are now, you know, in the greatest number in our history, together to find community, to find support and fellowship in the same way that World War II veterans have and Vietnam veterans have, who were mostly male. Women veterans have to learn more and more that they should go to the VA hospital, even that they have benefits there. I didn't know. I did not know what I, you know, what I now enjoy now, or at the VA rather. Women veterans and veterans generally need to understand that the VA is there to help them.
Absolutely. On that note, we're going to take a quick break and. And we will return to this this conversation in just a moment. And while Dr. Phillips was talking, we did get a phone call, but they hung up. So if you do want to join this conversation, please just let it ring until we have a chance to answer, because we, as I said, don't have operators standing by. It's just me. Again, the number is 786-KHUM. That's 786-5486. And, in fact, if you want to call during the break, that would be a fine time. We can get you ready. So we're about ready to wind this down. The topic that we're dealing with, sexual assault in the military, military sexual trauma, and we'll be right back here on KHUM after these quick words. It is 9:42, and you've got it on KHUM, and we are continuing our topic of this week, sexual assaults in the military. Wonderful panel of guests. I think we should probably kind of go around the room again. It's been a while since we have done so. So. Sherry, let's start with you.
I'm Sherry Johnson, Director of Field Education in the Department of Social Work at Humboldt State University and the Chair of the Humboldt County Domestic Violence Coordinating Council.
Mary Ann Hayes Mariani, North Coast Road Crisis Team.
And Kim Hall from Humboldt State University, Veterans Enrollment and Transition Services.
And joining us via telephone.
I'm Dr. Maureen Phillips. I'm a retired military intelligence officer and semi-retired college professor and also a veteran being treated for PTSD, MST.
And an author who has a book that will be coming out soon.
Soon.
Thank you for that.
Yes.
You're welcome.
We look forward to that.
We do. We do indeed. I, you know, just why we picked this topic, military sexual assault, and Cliff was just talking about how many military families there are here in Humboldt County. But just the fact that we talked to Colonel Ann Wright about 7 years ago when we first discussed this topic, when it really was not in the mainstream media at all, which we are prone to do. Mm-hmm. We're prone to talk about topics before they kind of get out there. But the May 7th, 2013 article in the New York Times talking about the discerned increase, the fact that they gave us a study out and about 108,000 active duty service members completed it, and they found that 26,000 people in the armed forces were sexually assaulted last year, up from 19,000 in 2010. And now there is this attention being brought to this issue in a way that we've never seen before. So just to remind us that historically we didn't even know how to talk about any sexualized violence. It was something that people experienced in silence and lived with or didn't live with for the rest of their lives. And now there's system response, there's conversation, there's resources, there's help, there's naming it in a way that gives us the power to actually do something about it. But of course, during the break is when the most fabulous conversations happen. And I was like, don't talk about that now. Okay, well, let's wait. But So Kim and Marianne and Cliff, do you really think there's more, and Marine, Dr. Marine, is there really more sexual assault in the military, or is something else?
I think it's actually just being reported more. I think people are more willing to come forward. That's been my experience in dealing with, in talking with various different people in the military. Marine, is that your thought as well?
Yeah, I think that's probably part of that statistical data, that the military has improved its reporting processes, and it's also much more accepted for someone to come out and say something about that. So, you know, that probably is part of those statistics.
Yeah, I would agree with that, because I think, you know, in the past, and working with military survivors, there were no, they lost all their rights. They had no right of confidentiality or any of that when they moved forward in reporting. And then it became a war zone for them in their situation, because they would tell someone, and then it would get all around, even to the perpetrator, before the survivor would even know that information was circling. And then they would be under attack again. So things have really changed a lot, and I think that allows for people to find the courage to find their voice.
And then, Kim, you were saying that in talking with women vets that there's been an increase in training.
Yeah, absolutely. A number of the women veterans up at Humboldt State had mentioned that, you know, they're mandatory meetings to go and trainings on this exact topic, and that it's drilled into them, if you will, about the language around it and reporting and so forth. But again, you know, you still have the culture to deal with and your own personal barriers to being able to do such that. But I agree. I think that now that people have words to put with it and they're able to sort out some of the more prominent mental disorders, that they can come forward or they can reach out for help for whatever. And they don't always present with that, as you know. You know, you may present with something different, depression or anxiety or something like that. But with more and more people aware, then you have more people that are being served.
I had the most amazing experience. A couple of years back, I was presenting a portion of my dissertation study at Eastern Oregon University, and in the audience, unbeknownst to me, there was a young enlisted woman who was invited there, actually, by my colleague who had invited me to lecture. And so I presented this lecture, and afterward, this young woman came up to me, and with this amazing look on her face, she said, "I did not know that we could talk about this. I didn't know that there was a way that other people could, you know, talk with me about this." And it was a moment, you know, and I said to her, yeah, we can talk about this. And, of course, my own painful plummet had not happened yet. But it was powerful, because there she was, you know, I think she was a reservist and a college student, and she found the message on the university campus, not in her unit. So I thought that was interesting to point out that now, you know, I am actually a volunteer for Employer Support of the Guard and Reserve, which is a national organization to support Guard and Reserve members who have civilian employers. And my task on that volunteer force is to go into military units to talk about the rights that military members have. And I'm going to begin, you know, emphasizing that there is actually a way to talk about this and to get with other people. In fact, I just emailed a Predator drone pilot friend that I've recently made, who said that a woman in his squadron is being bullied so severely and he doesn't know how to help her. And I emailed and said, "I can help her." And so, you know, reaching out, and the reason I'm saying all of this is because women in the military, especially women officers, are not coming forward in advocacy ways. And I made this point when I went to volunteer at ESGR. I said, "Where are the other women officers? I'm not the only retired woman officer, certainly even in Tucson. Where are they?" well, you know, they don't go to the VA, and they don't go and help other veterans. They stay at home, and they try to just act like nothing ever happened. And there is a shortage of women veterans, particularly women officers, because there's more at stake. And we need more women, retired women officers. And I also mentioned to the MST therapist at the VA here in Tucson that it should be really noted among therapists that if you get a group of veterans together in one room, they will read rank into that whether you want them to or not, because they've been trained to do that. And that's one of the things I mentioned in the...
Yep. Marina, you there?
Ow.
Another plane flew overhead. Right. Well, while we were waiting for Marina to call us back, we really only have time for some closing thoughts. So
Kim, why don't we start with you? Just one final thought about this.
You know, I was listening to you guys earlier, and I was just thinking about what she was saying, and you know, our message out there to seek services and to find the words for it. But something that wasn't mentioned was timing. You know, there's a lot of veterans, quite a few that I've spoken with, that understand what's going on, that have a clue with what they're dealing with, but the timing's not right. You know, the timing isn't right for them to go seek help. They're in the middle of a career, and it's the same within the military, right? Depending on where you're at, timing can be everything with this. And so... I would just urge people that before they get to the point that your life is completely disrupted, that they take a hard look at what they're going through and the self-care involved with it.
Okay. And Marina, I believe we have you back.
I do. I am. Sorry.
Another plane flew over?
Well, I just wanted to piggyback off that idea because I was in uniform when General Scoggins and I were interviewed by National Public Radio. And I was shaking in my combat boots when we were being interviewed because the implication for my military career was, you know, very real. So it's a very different thing when you're someone who's still, you know, on duty. And I think that's really great that Kim talks with veterans about that.
That is fantastic.
And I think with the timing thing, that is really important. I appreciate Kim mentioning that because... you need to deal with it when it works for you to deal with it, and that's important to prioritize that. And survivors need to know that the resources are available for them, whether these traumas happened to them decades ago or just recently. And we're another service that's available for sexual assault survivors of the military to call us and remain anonymous. Do what one needs to do to keep themselves safe and to honor the pace in which they need to heal. And that's where we would be coming from, is to honor people's healing process and respecting that.
And Marianne, can you give the crisis line number?
Yes, that would be helpful, wouldn't it? 707-445-2881. And that's in Humboldt County. And then in Del Norte County, there's 707-465-2851. Every minute of every day, someone there is ready to listen.
And we have a resource page attached to the KHUM website and the Stop the Violence webpage, where you can click, and it's somewhat interactive. It will direct you to the resource that you are seeking, and we wholeheartedly encourage you to do so. One of the consequences of Stop the Violence, Start the Healing is to start the healing part. And so that's why we want you to make a phone call as the first step.
Mm-hmm. And I guess my closing thoughts on this is it is good to see that there is some progress moving forward, that the military is taking this seriously, that the Secretary of Defense is taking this seriously, that it's now being brought before Congress. There's a law about to be voted on to take some of these trials out of the military's hands for a little bit more justice and remove the conflict of interest. But my final thought would be to men in the military to speak up. If you see something that is wrong, be a voice. as Dr. Phillips mentioned, you know, it's very powerful to have men speaking out as well. It was like, as you were saying, you know, white people in the March on Washington. It's that type of thing. We're in that kind of an era. You know, it may not be the early 60s, but it is with regard to this subject.
And that's the real courage, is when we ally and we do not stay silent in the face of abuse and oppression and do whatever it is we can do. And Dr. Phillips, Professor Phillips, Captain Marine, we cannot thank you enough. There just are no words to express our gratitude for how wonderful your participation was today and how you helped us, every one of us who were listening. And I look forward to meeting you in person and can't wait till you come down to Humboldt County for a visit.
Thank you so much. I would just like to thank Dr. Jen McGuire. She and I met while teaching at Oregon State University, and she is a remarkable scholar and a great addition to your HSU faculty. I'm so proud of her.
Me too.
Fantastic.
Me too.
All righty, we are unfortunately out of time. I want to remind folks that next week we resume our third week of our 18th Stop the Violence campaign. We're going to be talking about healing from trauma, as we always try to bring everything home and together. And the whole thing will be capped off with our healing breakfast, which is going to be on Stop the Violence Day, November 22nd, Friday, at the Women's Club in Eureka on J Street.
Eureka Women's Club. Mm-hmm. Free music, free pastries, information tables from wonderful organizations. Again, another panel and a keynote speech by Dr. Ronnie Swartz. And he will share his wisdom on healing from trauma as well. All three fabulous guests next week, Sherry Witt, Oceana Madrone, and the third person?
It's going to be Professor Michael Yellenberg.
Professor Michael Yellenberberg.
How could you forget that?
I don't know.
Just talking about mindfulness.
Yeah, right. Because you got the schedule in front of you.
I've got it in my hands. That's right.
So right. Please stay tuned and join us for our last week of Stop the Violence, Start the Healing.
All righty. And thanks to you, our listeners, for tuning in and staying tuned in to what can be a very difficult topic now and again. And this is how we move forward, by having a big community dialogue. Stop the Violence, Start the Healing. This is KHUM.